Welcome, everybody. Oh my gosh, so good to see so many people here. Yeah, my name is Mark. I know Ted wanted to say a few things.
I did. Is this being recorded?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, yeah, good morning. So, it's traditional here at Zen Center, when someone gives their first Sunday morning Dharma talk, they get an introduction, even if most of you know the person. So, it's my pleasure this morning to introduce Mark Terbeck. And he was ordained about a year and a half ago, and we've kept him pretty busy during that time with a lot of training, and he's done a lot in terms of service to the community during that time. And a partial list of things he's been involved in is teaching the introduction upstairs. He's organized the Habitat for Humanity Volunteer Days. He's done some work bringing the Dharma into prisons. He was work leader for a year, and he's currently Eno, and that's a pretty large job, organizing a lot of different things, retreats, daily practice, and things like that. And it's a two-year process. First, you're an assistant Eno for a year, and then you're Eno. And during all of this, he's brought a lot of enthusiasm to it, which has been great. And I suspect you're going to enjoy his talk.
Yeah, I thought it was fitting that I jumped right in before you came and officially introduced me. Yeah.
Well, we had that little snafu, which is good, because we get too set in our ways here.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Welcome, everybody. As I said, it's really, really good to see you guys. My name's Mark. I'm just really, really grateful and humbled to be here with you guys, just to have the chance to hang out for a bit and talk about this crazy, crazy Zen stuff that we do. And I was reflecting, it's Easter today, and I grew up Catholic, and it's fitting, here I am on Easter, and just like a Catholic church, the two front seats are empty, which is nice. Yeah, so if you look at your programs today, I wanted to talk about Indiana Jones and Zen practice, and the four principles of Indiana Jones Zen practice. And my title of my talk is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Ganshoji. Do you guys know where Ganshoji is? We're here. It's right here. Minnesota Zen Center. It's our traditional name of our temple is Living and Vow Temple, Ganshoji. I had a couple of recent experiences that got me thinking about Indiana Jones and Zen practice. And the first happened on our last day of Rohatsu just this past December. And that Sunday, if you guys were here, you'll remember we had this beautiful snowfall that night before. And it was kind of, it was just at about freezing, about 32 degrees. And it was like really that kind of wet, heavy snow that just hangs heavy on the branches. So the entire world as we got up, everything was just was just covered in this still, calm, untouched, pristine white. And it was really busy here. There was a lot of people coming here, and there was a lot of people outside, people walking their dogs, people out on walks with their friends and family, people out running, and it was just really cool. It met this great activity of this warm, beautiful snowfall. There was just this larger, untouched, larger, quiet, larger, pristine. And these two young guys, they were probably maybe, they might even have been in high school. They were at the most maybe freshman or sophomore in college, and they came into the Zen Center onto the front porch, and I was sitting out by the coat rack over there, and they came up, and they were talking to each other about the ski trip that they were going on, and one friend said to the other, "Yeah, man, it's going to be a great adventure," and the second friend went, "Yeah," and then he said, "Now, are you ready for this adventure?" And the first one said, "Yeah," and they came running into the Zendo. And I thought that was so cool. It was so cool. Because this is an adventure, guys. This moment here is an adventure. This moment is always changing, always fresh, always evolving. There'll be a never, ever another one like it, and it's gone, right? It's gone. But guess what? Here's another one. Here's another one ready for us. We have a saying in Zen that we should sit like our hair is on fire. Have you guys heard that saying? I think it's weird that we have that saying, considering all the bald people in Zen. But some of them are purposely bald, like Busho, and some of them are not so purposely bald, like me. So I think we should have a new saying that when we hear that Han hit and it's time to make our way into the Zendo, we should say we're going to enter the Zendo like Indiana Jones. Well, imagine we have our fedora on, we have our hip at our side, John Williams' score is playing behind us, and coming crashing down is that big boulder from Raiders of Lost Ark, right? We can enter into our practice with that same type of energy and that same type of enthusiasm. So the second experience that I got me thinking about Indiana Jones in Zen practice was this list I read. I love movies, and I was reading Empire Magazine, one of my favorite movie magazines, and I was reading one of their blogs, and they had this list of the 100 greatest movie characters of all time. Indiana Jones was number 2. Did anybody guess who number 1 was? Any guesses? James Bond, Citizen Kane. It was Vito Corleone from The Godfather. He was number 1. So written under number 2, Indiana Jones, the author had this blurb, and he said, Indiana Jones is the perfect combination of Sherlock Holmes, the man with no name, that being Clint Eastwood in old spaghetti westerns like Good, the Bad, the Ugly, James Bond, and Han Solo. So perfect combination of Sherlock Holmes, man with no name, James Bond, and Han Solo. So I started reflecting on those 4 movie characters, and I wanted to come up to see if we could figure out some practice archetypes to help, so maybe these 4 characters could help support us in our Zen practice. And I came up with these 4, the 4 that are in your program. So for Sherlock Holmes, we have quiet the mind. For the man with no name, we have start right here. For James Bond, we have do less. And then for Han Solo, we have don't take things too seriously. So I want to say real quick, though, about the Han upstairs. On the Han in Japanese. Do you know why are you laughing? Where I'm going? Oh, never mind.
Han Solo.
Ah! I love it. So transcribe, I'm going to think of the Han upstairs completely differently from now on. That Han does not shoot first. So on the Han upstairs, transcribed in Japanese are the words, awaken, awaken, make use of this precious life. And I think that's why we find Indiana Jones so compelling, right? Because in his own way, that's what he was doing. He was making use of this one precious life. And our Zen practice isn't any different. It's calling us to do exactly the same. Make use of this one precious life. All right, so let's begin talking about Sherlock Holmes. So I went to the library and I found this book, and it was called Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. And it was written by Marina Konnikova. And in the book, she says, if there is one thing I'd like readers to take away from this book, it's the most powerful mind is the quiet mind, mindful of its thoughts and emotions. I thought, that's cool. I can talk about quiet mind. But I really want to talk a little bit about exactly what do we mean when we say quiet the mind. It sounds like an obvious statement, but what are we really talking about when we say quiet the mind in Zen practice? And I think we have this idea in our culture that the mind and the heart are two separate things, right? But in our practice, they're one and the same, right? The heart and the mind share the same fabric of being, in the same way a physicist might talk about space and time sharing the same fabric of being, or they might talk about matter and energy sharing the same fabric of being. And our hearts and our minds aren't any different. So when we're talking about this practice of quieting the mind, we're not just talking about this intellectual activity. We're talking about this heart here, too. This heart here, too. My name, Doshin, that's my Dharma name. It means way of the heart-mind. So when we're talking about quieting the mind, we're also talking about these knots that we can so often feel in our hearts, you know. We're talking about these knots in our hearts and beginning to loosen these knots of our heart. And doing this practice, this really simple practice of coming back to our bodies, coming back to our breath, developing this mindfulness of our thoughts, developing this mindfulness of our feelings, is really about this loosening. It's loosening. We're creating a loosening, how we experience our bodies, how we experiencing these emotions coming up, how we experiencing these thoughts bubbling up and falling away, how we experience these stories we tell based upon these thoughts. And I know a lot of times in my personal life, these 4 things seem pretty tangled, right? Pretty constricted, right next to each other. Just this last Friday at work, I got an email from my boss. and my work's been really busy right now, and I've been just drowning and feeling like I'm drowning in emails. So I got this email from my boss, and I read the email, and I immediately felt this tense in my body. My shoulder, my chest feel constricted. I felt this tenseness in my jaw, and then these emotions started coming up, right? Frustration, irritation, and then based on those emotions, thoughts. Oh, these people really don't get it. No one works like hard as I do. If I really ran this place, man, it would be ship shape, right? These stories start coming up from these thoughts. And I wrote this email and I hit send. And then I thought, oh man, maybe I should have waited a little bit. Right? And then after that came this loosening, right? There was this loosening. These four things didn't seem to be so tight, so constricted, right? There started to be some space between those four. This is that same space that we can start developing how we experience our bodies by doing our Zazen practice, right? So because I had this space between how I felt my body, space between how I experienced these emotions and these thoughts and these stories, I could be connected to something greater, something wider, right? Something pristine and untouched, just like on that snowfall on that first morning of Rahatsu. Amidst that great activity, we're still this pristine, untouched white. Because I had a little bit more looseness and felt a little bit more calm, I was able just to go into my boss's office and knock on the door. And I said, hey, can I talk to you for a second? I just sent you an email, and I was a little excited. And we just talked it out. It wasn't so big of a deal, right? And I could stay connected to this greater intention, right? Stay connected to this one true heart of this practice just because I had this loosening. And I think when we talk about intention or action and skill and wholesomeness, I think this is really the heart of it, is this loosening. I love that idea, you know, when we talk about right action from a Buddhist perspective. We're not necessarily talking about right as in right or wrong, right? We're talking about right as in skill or wholesomeness. What I love about the word wholesome is I think about a loaf of bread. A loaf of bread my grandma would have made. It's wholesome nutrition. It's nutrition that really sustains and really feeds. But it's also wholesome as a whole. It's a circle. We're acting in a way that's incongruent and recognizes this vast interrelated universe that we live in, that we are all in it together. We're all connected, right? So what we're doing with this practice of slowing ourselves down, of bringing ourselves back to our body, developing these mindfulness of these thoughts and the emotions, we can begin watering these seeds. Watering the seeds of loving kindness, watering the seeds of compassion and wisdom that are already here. This soil, you guys, this soil is already ready. It's already ready. These seeds are already planted. Just up to us to do the watering, right? You know, this is what we mean when we say we are Buddha. We already have that awakened heart. We already have that awakened nature, right? Buddha nature is already here. We just need a little help once in a while to nudge us and remind us. Gary Lachman is this really cool writer. He's probably one of the only academic and scholars who's also a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He was the founding bass player for the band Blondie, and he quit rock and roll. He completely abandoned it and moved to England and became a scholar. And he has this great quote that often it feels like we're born with a nostalgia for a place we've never been. Often it feels like we're born with a nostalgia for a place we've never been. When I first heard that, I recognized it and I thought, oh man, I know that feeling. But the truth is, I think that nostalgia comes from the fact that we have been there. It's just that we've only felt like we've glimpsed it from time to time, right? I think we all recognize innately that this heart is awake. We all recognize innately that underneath this moment, regardless of what it may seem day to day, there is a stillness. There is a pristine. There is an untouched. It's just easy to forget, right? It's easy to forget. And I think that's why so many of us are drawn to a place like the Zen Center, because we want to remember that. We want to remember that. And I think central to this remembering is a circle of support. And it's drawing support. For me, I know that when I in times in my life when this practice has really shown up, and it seems like I create the space for to allow it to show up, or are times when I have this circle of support is the most strong around me. And I have the most number of touch points to reach out and grab a hold of this practice in one way, shape, or form. And I don't think right effort is a straight line that we charge down. Rather, right effort is the circle that we surround ourselves with. And this circle, I think, starts with a teacher. I think it's central in Zen that we have a teacher. I know a teacher who used to say that Zazen without a teacher is like Zazen without meditation. And a teacher can be someone here. It can be Ted. It can be Wanda. It can be Susan. But it doesn't have to be. I know somebody who thinks Thich Nhat Hanh is their teacher, and they've never met him. They've never met Thich Nhat Hanh. For me, Pema Chodron, Norm Fisher, Charlotte Jo Quebec are really important teachers to me. But there are other people that have nothing to do with Buddhism, like Michel de Montaigne or Sri Ramakrishna. And even I think we all have those folk Buddhas in our lives that are important teachers to us. Like my grandparents never heard of Buddhism, but here they are, like this perfect embodiment of compassion and wisdom coming together in the world. So we need support. And I think even like our own bodies are the same circle of support when we sit Zazen. When we sit Zazen, we bring together these three features of support. We bring together an upright posture, which supports this quieting of the mind and supports this deepening of breath. This mind of ours allows us to pay attention. It allows us to pay attention to this breath. Allows us to pay attention to this body, right? And this breath, so vital yet so easy to forget about, is this wonderful bridge between our breath and our body. Wonderful bridge between our minds and our bodies, right? And the Eightfold Path too is a circle of support, right? It's not a ladder. We don't start at right understanding and make our way to right meditation. We bring all these things together to support each other. We can have right meditation because we have right action and right effort. We can have right livelihood because we have right mindfulness and right speech. We can have right intention because we have right understanding and right action, for example. So, yeah. Okay. So let's move on. We can talk about our next principle of Indiana Jones Zen practice, and that's start right here. And this one is based on Clint Eastwood, or The Man with No Name. When I first started Zen practice, I really just wanted to hurt less. I wanted to feel less fear. I wanted to feel less anxiety. I didn't want emotions to feel so tense, tough emotions to feel so tense. And I very much pictured that Zen would allow me to walk, to meet my interior life and walk into my interior life the same way that Clint Eastwood walks into the saloon in an old Western, right? He walks into a saloon and all those innocent men, women, and children scatter. The bartender hides behind the bar. The piano player stops playing and runs off. And you hear all these tough emotions sitting around playing cards in their black hats and cigars dangling from their lips. And they all stand up slowly, and here I am, stoically and courageously. I can face them all down one at a time without losing my cool or my composure. And I very much had an idea that this Zendo was like a telephone booth. And I was like Clark Kent, right? I was like Clark Kent in this crummy brown suit that's a size too big, these clunky glasses, and this crummy job at the Daily Planet. And I could run into that telephone booth and I could emerge something bigger, something better, something stronger, right? This being impervious to bullets, this being faster than a locomotive, this being able to jump tall buildings in a single bound, right? And again, I had this idea, this Clark Kentness can't be me. This person who experiences emotions, fears, anxieties, hurts, this can't be who I really am. There's no way, right? Right? But this practice calls us to do something different than that. It doesn't call us to some magical other place. It doesn't call us to become something other, something bigger, something better. It doesn't allow us special access to a fortress of solitude where we can always know peace, calm, and quiet. But rather, this practice calls us to really start settling in, really start settling into our Clark Kentness, start settling into the suit that's too big and these clunky glasses, start settling into this crummy job as a beat reporter for the Daily Planet. And it's the settling in, that's where we start. That's where we start. And equally so, the settling in allows us to realize that this confused mind of ours, this is the awakened mind. This is the awakened mind. This confused being of ours, right? This confused self, this is Buddha nature. This is Buddha nature. As Busho said last week, we don't practice to become Buddha. We practice because we are Buddha. We are already there. When I first started thinking of taking this ordination path, like a little over three years ago, I met with Ted. And when I had this idea that I could maybe, perhaps, someday, way into the far, far, far distant future, I had this dim vision of I could become ordained. But not now. I had way too much work to do, right? No way I could start now. And I met with Ted, and I said, Ted, you know, I just want to meet because I want to express this intention I have. It's just burning in my heart, and I feel like I need to get it out. I think I might someday, way down the line, nowhere near today, I might want to become ordained. And Ted said, let's get started. And I was like, what? Get started? And Ted said, if you wait till you're perfect, it's never going to happen. Dogen in the Genjo Koan has this great quote, this great verse that a fish doesn't need to wait to know the whole ocean to start to swim. A bird doesn't need to wait to know the whole sky to start to fly. And we don't need to wait to know this greater perfection to begin right here. Because this greater perfection is just an idea, guys. It's just an idea. This right here is the good stuff. This is it, guys. So let's do it. Let's get started. And we get to do it together. That's what's really the coolest thing for me is. We get to do it together. And I really need you guys. You guys give me so much support. I was just thinking later today, I'm going to be hanging out with my family for Easter. I'm going to be able to hang out with my nephew and my two nieces and my wife and my sister and my mom. And one of the reasons I get to really hang out with them and I get to really meet that experience is because of you guys. You guys coming here and supporting me to do this practice. And that's really cool. All right. Okay. Let's move on and we can shift gears a little bit and talk about our third principle of Indiana Jones practice, and that's do less. And this is my favorite one to talk about. So I started exploring how James Bond can support our Indiana Jones Zen practice by Googling 10 ways to be as cool as James Bond. And I came up with a list. The first on the list simply said, suit up. And the second on the list said, do less. And I think it's really important when we talk about doing less from this Zen, from a Zen perspective, we're not talking about necessarily the exterior, our exterior lives, the things that are out there, but we're talking about the things that are in here. So we're not talking about our to-do list or making time for a spa weekend or work-life balance. That's really important. That's not quite what we're talking about. When we're talking about doing less, we're talking about doing less in terms of how we meet this moment here. Doing less in terms of this mental activity that we so often bring to this moment here. You know, this habit mind of ours, I think, which we all know well, that explains, complains, reviews, analyzes, predicts, resents, regrets, explains, complains, reviews, analyzes, predicts, resents, regrets. Talking about slowing that down. Kierkegaard, in his essay, This That, I think, describes this complaining mind well. Marry and you will regret it. Don't marry, you will regret it. Marry or don't marry, you will regret it either way. Laugh at the world's foolishness, you will regret it. Weep over it, you will regret that too. Whether you were laugh or weep, you will regret both. I can't help but feel Kierkegaard maybe just needed a nice pick-me-up bouquet. One of these great flower arrangements Rob made. It would have made a big difference. So our practice offers us an alternative, to this that mind, and what I'm going to call is that so mind. You guys might know this story of Hawkwind and Is That So, and Matt, you're nodding. This is one of my all-time favorite stories in all of Buddhism. I first shared this story, Is That So, with a group of the guys who were part of the North Star Sangha and their group of male offenders that sit at Minnesota State Correctional Facility in Faribault. And after I read this story, the whole room just got it, instantly got it. There was just instant recognition, and they were laughing and talking about it. And because these guys, they sort of live Is That So every day of their lives. So here's the story. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near Hawkwind. One day, without any warning, her parents discovered she was pregnant. This made her parents very angry. She would not confess who the man was, but after much harassment, at last named Hawkwind. In great anger, the parents went to the master. "Is that so?" is all he would say. After the child was born, it was brought to Hawkwind. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him. But he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else the child needed. A year later, the girl could not stand it any longer. She told her parents the truth. The real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market. The mother and the father at once went to Hawkwind to ask forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the child back. Hawkwind willingly yielded the child, saying only, "Is that so?" So like Hawkwind has a lot of reasons to explain and complain, right? A lot of reason to bring this, that mind to it. But he chooses to do something different. Just kind of lets go of some of those fixed views. Doesn't have them so wrapped up, so tight. Admits that great activity. He stays connected to that greater untouched, that greater spaciousness, that greater calm, pristine white. And by doing that, he can really take care of this life here, this life in front of him, this life that is so fragile, so precarious, so little. Right? You can really meet it and really take care. I was thinking it would be an interesting experiment to go on my Facebook feed and under every article just post, "Is that so?" Well, maybe I don't need to go on anything. I think you guys already get it. Cool. All right. So now we're doing great on time. We can talk about our next and last principle of Indiana Jones Zen practice, and that's don't take things too seriously. And this is based on that scruffy nerf herder Zen master Han Solo. So Oscar Wilde said that life is far too important to take seriously, and I think our Zen practice is exactly the same. It's far too important to take seriously. And often when, I know for me, when I take this practice too seriously, you know, I find I have a tendency to diminish its value and diminish its importance because I create a separation. I create a gap between myself and the Zen practice. And I want to take this Zen practice and I want to put it on a shelf. And I want to call it something special. I want to call it, maybe give it a nice sheen of religion, give it a nice sheen of dogma, give it a nice sheen of holy. But in doing so, I'm kind of missing a hugely awesome opportunity, right? Hugely opportunity. This Zen practice of ours is kind of like our friends when we're little kids and they're standing on their front yard calling us out of our house, "Come and play, come and play, come and play," right? And it's only by letting go of that specialness, letting go of that seriousness, that we can really invite this practice in, really bring it into our hearts and really meet it here. Meet it here. And I think I want to add, you know, I had a sponsor when I first started doing AA stuff who said he was a practical agnostic. He said, if it works for me, I go for it, and And if it doesn't, I let it go. And I think taking the same spirit to this practice is really helpful, you know. If making something into a religion or calling it holy, if that supports us and helps us bring it into our hearts, that's really good. That's really good. But if it doesn't, we can just let it go. We can just let it go. Because really, and from the big mind perspective, there's no Zen. There's no Buddhism. There's no Bodhisattva. There's no Buddha. There's just our lives. That's all that exists is our lives, right? Our lives calling to us to come closer, come closer, come closer, and come out and play. All right. So I think I'd like to do now is introduce you to who I feel is the ideal Indiana Jones Zen practitioner. That is Mr. Coffee. Mr. Coffee. So Mr. Coffee, he's pretty quiet, right? We can easily miss him chilling out in the kitchen, right? He starts right here. He doesn't feel a need to make any special fancy espressos or cappuccinos. Coffee's good enough, right? He does less. Doesn't have a lot of fancy special features. Just maybe a clock and an on button, right? Doesn't he take himself too seriously? It's really easy to use. Just plug in, fill the filter, press on, put water into, I guess. A little more complicated than that, I guess. But pretty easy, right? And I think Mr. Coffee has this great, great parable of the Bodhisattva vows for us, too. Not many people know this, but for those of you who might remember, Joe DiMaggio was the first pitchman for Mr. Coffee. And really, he was the reason why Mr. Coffee became so ubiquitous in homes. He really popularized it. The man who invented Mr. Coffee went to Joe DiMaggio 55 times to meet with him. And each time he was rejected. Every time Joe DiMaggio said, I'm too busy. I can't meet. I'm too busy. And it was finally on the 56th time that this guy, Joe DiMaggio, agreed to have lunch with this guy, the guy who invented Mr. Coffee. And over lunch, they made a handshake deal, and Joe DiMaggio became the spokesman. Right? So this guy is just like Hawkwind. This inventor is just like Hawkwind. Every time Joe DiMaggio says no, he just meets it with, is that so? Is that so? Right? So I think the central question for me is, what does this all have to do with suffering? Our practice at its core is an attempt to address the condition of suffering. And how do these four practices, these four principles, how do they help support us to really meet the cries of this tired and hurting world of ours? How do they really help support us to do our practice of turning towards suffering and not pushing it away, right? Our practice at its heart is really forming a radical new relationship with suffering, where we can learn just how to be with suffering, be still with it, develop an ability to see it clearly, right? Again, not grab a hold of, not push away, just stay present to it. And it's in that quiet, that we can really start to develop the ability to develop a deeper knowing of how to respond. And this is what we mean by skillful means, is that deeper knowing. And just as Katagiri Roshi often said, you don't sit zazen, zazen sits zazen. I feel the same way about skillful means. We don't do skillful means. Skillful means does skillful means. And skillful means at its heart is in a recognition that this Mr. Coffee, last week, Busho held up a photo of the earth rising above the moon's horizon. Do you remember that? Maybe? So yeah, it was great. He showed this photo of the earth rising above the moon's horizon, and he said, in that photo exists the totality of human experience. In this photo, too, exists that same totality. We read this great article. If anybody here is really interested in what this Bodhisattva path of ours, how we can live this Bodhisattva path to meet some of these big challenges of ecological destruction, racial inequality, economic disparity. David Loy has a great article called The New Bodhisattva Path, and I definitely recommend anybody here who's interested in these questions takes a look at it. It's really, really powerful and well done. And I think he sums up this question of what we do have to do with meeting the needs of our world well. And I'll just read part of it here. As T.S. Eliot put it, ours is in the trying. The rest is not our business. The bodhisattva's job is to do the best one can without knowing what the consequences will be. Have we already passed the ecological tipping points and human civilization is doomed? We don't know. Yet rather than by being intimidated, the bodhisattva embraces don't know mine. Because Buddhist practice opens us up to the awesome mystery of an impermanent world where everything is changing, whether or not we notice it. I grew up in a world defined by a cold war between the USA and the Soviet Union we all took for granted, until communism suddenly collapsed. The same thing occurred with South African apartheid. If we don't really know what's happening, how do we really know what's possible until we try? I'm going to read that last part again because I love it. If we don't really know what's happening, how do we really know what's possible until we try? So I'd like to close with a couple of poems, one by Issa and the other by Hafiz. Here's the first one by Issa. Giddy grasshopper, take care. Do not leap and crush these pearls of dewdrops. Giddy grasshopper, take care. Do not leap and crush these pearls of dewdrops. I think of those two young guys as a couple of giddy grasshoppers. The second is one of my wife and my favorite poems, Cast All Your Votes for Dancing by Hafiz. Cast all your votes for dancing. I'm going to put right in vote, dancing. I know the voice of depression still calls to you. I know those habits that can ruin your life still send their invitations. But you are with friends now and look so much stronger. You can stay, excuse me. You can stay that way and even bloom. Keep squeezing the drops of the sun from your prayers and works and music, and from your companion's beautiful laughter. Keep squeezing the drops of the sun from the sacred hands and glances of your beloved. And my dear, from the most insignificant movements of your own holy body. Learn to recognize the counterfeit coins that may buy you just a moment of pleasure, but then drag you down for days, like a broken man behind a farting camel. You are with friends now. Learn what actions of yours delight him and what actions of yours bring you freedom and love. Whenever you say God's name to your pilgrim, my ears wish my head was missing so they could finally kiss each other and applaud all your nourishing wisdom. Oh, keep squeezing the drops of the sun from your prayers and works and music, and from your companion's beautiful laughter, and from the most insignificant movements of your own holy body. Now, sweet one, be wise. Cast all your votes for dancing. Cool. Well, thanks, everybody. Why don't we have some time. Maybe we can just kind of chat for a little bit. Maybe somebody has a question or a comment. Go ahead, Jim.
Excellent first talk.
Thanks. Yeah.
I wanted to comment that saying that Zazen is too important to take serious is exactly what I needed to hear right now. My Zazen's been getting a little difficult lately. I think I'm taking it too seriously.
That's great. Other thoughts? Cool. Go ahead.
I just want to thank you for your closing of that poem.
Yeah. I love that poem. Go ahead. Is that Jason?
Yeah.
Hey.
Do you have a favorite email or other unrepresented group?
Well, I'm not actually much of... I don't know much about superheroes as I do movie characters. And I guess everything that we said about Indiana Jones could be said well about Shaft. I'm trying to think of a good woman. I think what comes to mind, I think Scarlett O'Hara, as we can very say well about a lot of these same practices with her. She would be a great bodhisattva figure. I don't know, is there anybody else? I should throw it to you guys.
I have one.
Go ahead.
Alicia Keys is my hero.
Yeah.
Good. I watched an interview with her on TV one time, and she said that she was, in her life, her project was to take layers off herself one by one until she could find out who she really was under all those layers. And she seems to me to be so free and joyous.
That's
in her
awesome.
Life whenever I see her. I've never seen her in person, but she really inspires me.
That's awesome. She is a really good one.
Who is she? She's a contemporary singer.
She's on The Voice, if you watch that show. Go ahead, Lena.
Buffy the Vampire.
Ah! Nice. That's a good one.
I'm not scared.
Oh! That's a great one. And now that I'm realizing it, there's this great book, Faces of Compassion, by Tygen Dan Layton. And every chapter is about a different bodhisattva, and there's 10 total. And at the end of one, he draws comparison from real life and fictional, real life individuals and fictional characters that are embodiments of these figures. Like Samantabhadra, he draws comparisons with everybody from Gandhi to Roberto Clemente. So that'd be a cool book to check out. Other thoughts, comments? Go ahead.
I'll let you know this week when my boss tells me I'm behind on my project and I say, is that so?
Please do, Mitch. That's awesome.